Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, February 4th, 2004, and coming to you live from WGMU in George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict.
Optimistic in the sense that it's very well publicized, incredibly well attended, and so I think I'm optimistic about the process to see this many people involved on an early Saturday morning.
Everybody's been severely affected by the events of 9/11. We all live in communities that lost a number of people as a result of these events. And we'd like to do our part to see that there is a fitting tribute to everybody and that these events are remembered not only for the terrible tragedy that occurred, but for how our country is rising above it now and recovering.
I am a trainer and a mediator in Oakland, California, and one of my mediator peers told me about it, and I went online and filled out the registration form, and here I am.
It was a very well thought out process that allowed people to learn more in the way of information about things to consider, in a way of eliciting their ideas, and more importantly, interacting with each other and having influence on each other. We just took an informal poll, and about 80% of the people said, "I learned something new today," and about the same number said, "My opinions shifted in the course of the day." And in my own little table, I'm really pleased that that has happened, because it shows people were sharing in good spirit, and they were listening with an open mind and open heart to what was going on.
I think there's cross-pollination. People get to hear other people's points of view and so see things in a way that maybe they hadn't seen it before.
We were told there'd be a very diverse set of people with diverse sets of opinions, and it was every bit as diverse and provocative as I thought it might, more so than I thought.
A meeting of this type is a milestone in the operation of the city of New York, because it brings people who don't consider themselves important, and too many of them don't even vote, and make them suddenly realize that they are important and they do have input into what's going on in our city. And this city needs more of its population to speak up. I think this technique is the best I've experienced in any events I've attended, and I've lived a long time, so I've attended a lot.
The 21st Century Town Meeting, that's what they call it, and you just heard a few comments from participants and facilitators from just such a meeting that took place in New York City in the summer of 2002. The event was designed and facilitated by an exciting new organization called America Speaks, which is headquartered right here in Washington, D.C. And today, on this 14th edition of Conflict, the radio program that explores and showcases innovative, constructive, and non-adversarial approaches to addressing conflict, we will take an in-depth look at how gatherings designed by America Speaks have demonstrated the power of dialogue in overcoming differences and seeking collaborative solutions to important issues facing communities all over. To help us understand how the organization operates and to hear some stories of success, we are very fortunate to be joined live in the studio today by founder and president of America Speaks, Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sean. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Let's start right off. Who is America Speaks, the organization?
The organization is a 501c3 that I founded in 1995 to look at the issue of how do we get the general interest public back into influential dialogues with elected officials and decision makers. You know, we have a real gap in this country between regular people and the people we elect after we elect them, when they're looking at critical issues like health care, like quality education, like access to jobs. And frankly, I'm delighted that we're talking here on the morning after the biggest set of primaries so far.
Right.
You know, people in this country are very frustrated about what can they do to have more influence on the public policy issues that impact their lives. Our focus is on those public policy issues after the officials are elected. But I would be remiss not to take a moment today to say the first thing that each of us should do as citizens of this extraordinary nation is take our civic responsibility seriously and get out there and vote.
Absolutely.
These are real choices. Who ends up in those offices makes a huge difference on your children's education, your access to jobs, health care, etc.
Which brings us right to this whole notion of voting and what that means as an act of participatory democracy in our country. Up until now, that's pretty much the most widespread understood way to participate in our democracy, right? Is to check a ballot. But now with America Speaks, you're kind of transforming how people can participate. Say a little more about how you operate.
We're saying that people need to be involved way past the ballot box, Sean. We're saying that when a mayor or when a governor or when a president has a critical choice in front of them that has huge implications for the people that live in this city, this state, this country, there should be ways for the collective citizen voice to come together to say, what do we believe are this country's values about health care? Is it acceptable that 35 to 45 million people, depending on whose numbers you accept, have no access to insurance in this country? And what we know is that the general public doesn't believe that's right. And yet we don't have mechanisms to bring that public together to show with force and clarity how strongly they feel about the fact that in one of the wealthiest, probably the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth in the history of the earth, it's unacceptable for people to be left without a safety net. When people come together, collectively look at the options for reform on a critical issue like this, it's been America Speaks' experience that there's no question that the vast majority of people in this country want to take responsibility for the whole. They want, in fact, not just their kids to get a good education, they want everyone's children to get a good education. The way America Speaks works is that we bring together demographically representative groups of people. Maybe if I give a concrete example, that'd
sure.
be great for the listeners. We've worked with Mayor Williams in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has a population of about 586,000 people. If you look at census data, that gives you the breakdown. How many of them are what age? How many of them are what income level? How many of them are what race? So when Mayor Williams is preparing his budget, we pull together 3,000 to 4,000 people that are representative of each of those demographic statistics and the city's geography. So when we get together in the convention center, like we just did on November 15th at the end of last year, and there are 3,000 people in the room, the mayor can have confidence they're from every neighborhood. They're from Brentwood. They're from Northwest, they're from Southeast, they're from every place. And they're in the room in a very close to the right numbers by age, by income, by race, and by gender. And in that forum, we actually looked at the five or six major policy issues in education, in crime prevention, in economic development, in substance abuse is mm-hmm. a critical issue in Washington, D.C., particularly as it relates to employment. So we looked at those issues and the potential numbers of dollars that could be put into the mayor's next budget mm-hmm. round. He's going to have to make choices. There isn't enough money to fund everything. And literally this mayor has said, I shouldn't be, the council shouldn't be the only people making choices. The citizens ought to have an opportunity to look at those policy choices in crime, in education, in public, in economic development, and do their own rank ordering of which of the policies they most prefer.
So I guess normally something like this might happen in perhaps some sort of focus group. The mayor might call a few citizen representatives from each area of the city together in his office or something like that. But you did something just a little bit different than that.
We take it much larger scale, and we make it much easier for anyone to attend.
Mm-hmm.
The real dilemma for elected officials these days, particularly on a budget issue, is they're essentially bombarded by special interest groups. And the elected official has very little way of knowing what's the balance of the general public that is interested in affordable housing compared mm-hmm. to the balance of the general public that's interested in crime prevention. We know the public's interested in both, but we have to understand how do you divvy up tough choices in resource allocation by virtually where the majority of the population feels the biggest investment should be made.
And so how is it that anybody can participate, and what does it look like when they come together?
The recruitment process is very transparent, very public. You start with the things you'd expect. It's in the Washington Times. It's in the Washington Post. It's in all the neighborhood newspapers, Northwest Current, et cetera, all the ethnic newspapers. Then we also understand, though, that for a lot of people whose lives make it more difficult for them to spend a Saturday in the convention center, they need to be contacted specifically mm-hmm. to understand that there's childcare available, there's transportation available, that there'll be food during the event. So we actually use telephone tree call, the good old-fashioned mm-hmm. telephone trees, started out of churches, started out of interest groups that look at things like poverty, that look at things like housing, so that we really set a broad net out into the city to say all are welcome. Then as people register, we basically use a matrix that shows these demographics. Mm-hmm. So we can see that we're getting a little too many people from Ward 5 uh-huh. and not quite enough people from Ward 3. So we put the people from Ward 5 on a waiting list if we've got those seats filled and do more recruitment in Ward 3.
Wow.
And that way, by the time the day comes, you actually end up with a group of people in the convention center, 3,000 strong, that are from every neighborhood in the city and every demographic in the city.
Wow, that's amazing. So it's not just that you put an invitation out there and whoever shows up. It's a quite intentional process throughout the registration
Very
phase.
Much so, Sean. Yeah. Because in a democracy, a critical variable is every voice at the table. And in far too many public processes, we've come to a place that there are actually very few voices at the table.
Mm-hmm.
So we believe in this recruitment process, it is absolutely essential that every segment of the community have people in the room.
And now I understand in some of these events, you've actually extended this to an online community for those who are not able to attend.
We have
New
done
York.
That, Sean. Yeah. A good example of that was the process that you were referencing as you began the show. We were honored to be invited by the authorities, the Lower Manhattan Development Authority, the Port Authority, and something called the Civic Alliance, which was a coalition of all the citizen and business and education groups that came together around 9/11. To actually do this for almost 5,000 people in July 20th in 2002. But we knew there were thousands more people that wanted to participate. So we actually took the exact same participant discussion guide, the exact same discussion questions, the exact same agenda, and we collaborated with an organization called WebLab to put that online for 2 full weeks after we'd done the face-to-face meeting in the Javits Center. And those people were, again, in diverse small table discussions, virtually speaking, mm-hmm. about 30 people per discussion, discussing, again, what they believed about the skyline, what they believed about the transportation hub, what they believed about each of the same policy questions that people in the Javits Center were able to deal with on July 20th.
So you get to a point where you have a representative population, as much as possible, in the room. Let's get into a little more about what that looks like. You come into a room, and what does it look like?
Well, I hope your listeners can visualize this, but imagine walking into a big auditorium or a basketball court or a convention center, and on the floor of the court or the floor of the center, it's just covered with round tables. Each table holds 12 people, 11 participants, and one facilitator. And the diverse population, although you can't have every segment at every table, mm-hmm. we make sure that each table has a different age group, different racial group from a different geography. Because part of the wonderful aspect of people coming together for these discussions is you get to talk to and meet people who live lives totally different than your own. For whatever reasons it's happened in the United States today, most of us spend most time not at work with people who are like-minded, who are very much like us. They're our church group, they're our athletic team, whatever they might be. It's unusual for us to be around a table in an organized discussion with people who are much different than ourselves. So the critical thing you'd see first is, let me take the D.C. example. 300 tables, 12 people at a table. every table very, very diverse. Then at each table, the reason we can do this in such large groups is at each table, as the citizens talk about their budget priorities, they have a laptop computer at the table. And as they come to their decision about the policy options in policing, do we favor more community policing, more men and women on the streets in my neighborhood? Or do we favor Giuliani's program of low tolerance for any kind of crime? Let's incarcerate people immediately for graffiti, for loitering, for whatever. Those are the kinds of choices citizens talk about. Once they've made their decision, they tap it into their laptop computer. Each of the 300 tables has had the same discussion. They tap their responses into the computer. That's all sent to a main computer sitting with a group of people we call the theme team. And if you can imagine, again, you're sitting in front of a computer screen, and so to speak, the answers or the reports from each table come in front of you on that screen. And those members of the theme team just keep reading all the responses from all the tables. And you can imagine, any time people are talking about the same territory, there's convergence. There's ideas that literally come up from almost every table. Then their ideas might be a great idea, but that only one table happened to talk about it. So the theme team organizes that data into ideas that dominated most of the tables, and we project those back up on large video screens, just like you'd see at the movie theater if it's a very large event, or just like you'd see at a sports bar if it's a slightly smaller event. And on that screen come up the responses from all 3,000 people. We really believe that the most dollars should go into hiring more men and women who will actually patrol our neighborhood streets to prevent crime. And I'm giving you a real example of it. That was the highest selected in crime prevention at the Citizen Summit in D.C. Once we've seen the information from the whole room, then there's still choices that have to be made. The comparison for the high priorities between crime prevention and education and job creation, to name a few. So each citizen has what's called just a keypad voting device. When we first started doing this work in 96, 97, most people had never seen this and had no idea what it was. It kind of looked like your remote control from your television. But then, since Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, everybody in the country knows what a keypad polling device is.
Right.
So each citizen has one of those devices, and at several points during the day, each person, as an individual, anonymously, gets to vote. I heard the discussion. I had my input with my group. But now I personally really believe more dollars have to go into education than anything else in Washington if we're ever going to be the kind of world-class city that we want to be.
I'm curious, do you ever do any, with regards to the keypad polling or voting, do you ever do any before and after to see how the discussion itself has actually affected individual opinions?
We do that, where sometimes we ask people to vote right at the beginning of the discussion, before they've had any discussion. Of these five options, which do you personally favor? And then later on, after they've had an hour and a half discussion, and we've seen how the whole room's voted, we then go back to your individual vote and say, well, how would you vote today? And that does give us a very clear indication of how people's values change.
Interesting. Who sets the agenda for these gatherings? I mean, certainly you bring 3,000 people together, and there's going to be a lot of different concerns in that room. Who really sets the agenda? How is that done to decide what will be discussed that day?
That's a great question, Sean. In each of our projects, we identify who are the critical stakeholders in this. I'll use a D.C. example again. Clearly, Mayor Williams and council members will make the eventual final decision on budget. So they're involved in the design of the day and the question program. Clearly, citizens themselves have a huge stake in where the outcomes come in the budget. So we actually do meetings with small groups of citizens ahead of time when we're zeroing in on the definition of the questions, and they give us feedback around, you know, that question really helped me think deeply how I feel about affordable housing. Or, you know, that question was too superficial. That really didn't help me understand anything more in-depth about how I feel about affordable housing than before I walked in the door.
So you use kind of a focus group process
in
order to figure out the questions and see how they resonate with the citizens.
Yes. And the critical thing we're looking for is, did it help them think more deeply and more fully about the choice they're going to be asked to make.
Mm-hmm.
We're not asking them to make any preferences at that point. We're just asking them, does this question help you deepen the dialogue?
Right.
We know eventually their values and their ideas will help them make the actual choice. But the question is, did this open up a better discussion?
Now, speaking of discussions opening up, I can just imagine that these tables must just be buzzing with, you know, a multiplicity of opinions and views and ideas. And I'm wondering, with so many people attending, it must be challenging to get everyone on the same page, at least regarding the purpose of the gathering. So even though the objectives have been published and even stated that at the beginning, do you ever find that participants show up with some pet peeve or some specific agenda of their own that they want to get through? And certainly that needs to be validated, but how is that handled?
That's an excellent question, Sean. I think I'll give you a different example.
Sure.
A few years ago, our method, our 21st century town meetings, were used on a discussion nationally on Social Security reform.
Mm-hmm.
Now, practically every family in the United States of America has a real experience with Social Security. A lot of folks don't realize this, but Social Security is not just a retirement fund. Fully a third of the dollars that go out on a monthly basis in Social Security go to people with disabilities or go to the widows or widowers and children of spouses who have died. So in Social Security, we knew people would come in with their own agendas. Maybe it'd be a constituency problem. My aunt hasn't gotten her disability check for mm-hmm. many, many months. So we understood that the most important reason we were in that community was for the discussion on reform. Should benefits be cut? Should revenues be increased? Should we look at privatization? But we wanted to respect people who had those kind of constituency issues. So the way we worked it in that particular forum, Sean, was we actually had on-site representatives from the Social Security Administration. So say you were a facilitator at a table where a woman came in with real distress about her aunt's disability check. Then you as the table facilitator could say to her, Rosie, you have a choice. There's someone here from Social Security Administration that will talk with you right now about
wow.
your constituency problem. Or you may want to stay in our discussion about the reform, and then at the end of the program, you can go and speak with the counselor about your constituency problem. And you know what was just amazing about people in this country? We did this with 55,000 people in 25 different states. Only two times did people choose to leave the reform discussion to deal with their constituency
really?
Problem first. Now, lots of people dealt with the people
sure.
about that, but they waited until the end of the day. Why? Because they wanted to have their voice heard on the reform issue as much as they wanted to deal with the personal issue that they brought into the forum.
Now, in terms of people hearing or knowing that their voices are heard, this notion of validation, what do you think is more important, that they know they're being heard or that their opinions are actually being acted on? I mean, if you had to weigh it, it seems like, again, going back to the idea of the theme team, they bring in all, they process all these, the input from the multiple tables, and you might have the same type of comment coming from almost every table. And so, even though it may be a generally understood concern, if a table thinks or feels like they came up with that themselves and then they see it flashed on the screen, that must be a very validating experience for them. And
it's, you know, this is not a word we use very often in our society and public processes. But I think there's almost some moments of magic in these large events
mm-hmm.
when people have been intensely talking at their own tables and then they see up on the screen that the ideas that they just spent an hour and a half talking about are clearly the things that thousands of other people really care about and really want their elected officials to do something about. It is a sense of community that is far too infrequent in the lives that we're now leading in this country. But I want to come back to the way you asked the question.
Sure.
Is it more important that their voice be heard or that it be acted on? And I want to say, in terms of how often citizens in this country or residents in this country, because our forums are full of immigrants as well as citizens, both of those are equally important. And it isn't enough just to be heard. There are too many examples for people today of where they went to a public meeting, it looked like they were heard, and then nothing happened.
Sure.
So I actually say when I'm speaking to decision makers or when I'm speaking to the public, the only way a citizen is going to know for sure that they were heard is that they can see the actions that you took because of what they did.
So this, of course, begs the question of all these forums that America Speaks has managed or facilitated so far. Do you have any examples of situations where that really has come true, or where citizens have noticed that their unique interaction that day actually did make a difference?
I am delighted to be able to say not do we have one or two examples, but we have many examples.
Well, share them. I'd love to hear them.
Obviously, the most heartwarming and extraordinary in terms of our current world dilemmas were the outcomes of listening to the city and the destruction of the World Trade Center towers. The phase at which we did our large public process was the earliest stage, when the Port Authority had still asked the designers to keep the original, what's called the original program, on the 16 acres. And what it meant was that the designers had to put 11 million square foot of commercial space, had to put 600,000 square foot of hotel space, and had to put 600,000 square foot of retail space besides the 11 million office space, and still find room for a memorial.
So put everything that was there before and
add a memorial. Now, common sense would say that's going to be pretty difficult to do in a respectful way. And the citizens of New York and New Jersey and Connecticut came together and said, none of these designs are acceptable, because there is not a capability of designing in a respectful way to honor the dead, to honor the spirit of freedom and dignity and democracy, and do all these multiple other things. It was so much consensus, it was such a clear message, that literally 1 week later, Governor Pataki said to the Port Authority and the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, we have to start over. We have to give different specs or a different request for proposals. And your listeners, I know, will remember that's the stage when they did the entire RFP process over and went to a world competition. And then some months later, there were seven new designs. Now, for the citizens who participated that day, not only was that the big no that was heard around the world, but beneath that, there was tremendous amount of data in the computers and in the final report we were able to give to the authorities. What did citizens want in a skyline? What did citizens want in a transportation hub? And much to everyone, I think's amazement, the two authorities wrote the RFP literally connected to the places where there was high convergence in what citizens wanted. So it was right there for not just the people who participated to see, but frankly anyone who wanted to look at the record, that you couldn't have asked for more congruence between what the collective group of citizens said at the Javits Center and online, and what went into that evaluation for new design teams to compete against.
And for that specific example, if I understand correctly, the information that they ultimately acted upon, those themes, the conversions that they recognized, was something that came out of the dialogue. It's not as if the participants would have voted on those specific points. It's that those came out as actual recommendations based on the dialogue the citizens had over other points that were ultimately
That's very well said, Sean. Literally, the consensus that was there at the end of the day came out of the hours in which each table pored over the designs, looked at the choices, talked back with one another, sent their responses to the theme team, got to see up on the big screens what everyone thought, then went back to their tables and worked some more, came up with the next iteration, until it came to a place that there was a real sense of a rank ordering of what we want to have at that site.
Wow, that's fascinating. In a moment, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the technology that really brings this together. But first of all, just a quick announcement to anyone who is just now tuning in. You're listening to Conflict on WGMU Radio, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, on 650 AM, GMU Cable Channel 22, and worldwide on WGMUradio.com. You can listen to this program and any other previous programs on conflictradio.org. And today we're speaking with Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer. She is the president and founder of just an amazing organization right here in D.C. called America Speaks. Dr. Lukensmeyer, I'm wondering if you could give us some examples of other types of forums. You've mentioned D.C., mm-hmm. the Citizen Summit called by Mayor Anthony Williams, and the rebuilding of the World Trade Center process up in New York. What are some other types of events or forums that you've convened?
Let me give you several other examples, but can I give you one more example of the
sure.
concrete outcome?
Absolutely.
Because the way citizens watch, because I've said so much about D.C. Summit.
No, please.
The first time we do this for Mayor Williams, in terms of the actual budget that he then produced and took to council and to Congress, for mm-hmm. those of your listeners outside of this area, remember we still don't have a vote here in D.C., there were actually about $650 million of the city's discretionary budget that went to different line item programs as a result of
really?
The citizens' input. So that's when public officials come to us and say they'd like us to do this kind of project, what we say to them is you have to make it totally transparent at the end of this process how what the citizens said to you impacted the choices you made. So that's a criteria we use before we even agree to do a project. But let me give you examples of other
sure.
projects. We worked in the state of Colorado recently. They're in a very, as is happening all across the country because of the downturn in the economy until recently, and some federal government choices about more unfunded mandates around the country. State and local budgets are in serious crises. So we worked in the state of Colorado for them to look at what would have to change in their constitution to actually have more options about how to raise revenues to deal with their particular crisis. We've worked in a county in southern Ohio. It happens to be Hamilton County. Some of your listeners may recognize mm-hmm. Cincinnati as the sort of core city in that particular area. Their regional planning commission was looking at a new 30-year plan for the whole county. This is in one of the most complex projects we've
sure.
worked on because there were 57 different government jurisdictions that had to approve of a consensus that came out of the work we did.
Wow.
It took a 2-year process, and I'm delighted to report to your listeners that the county that did this actually just received an award for the most impressive public participation process seen anywhere in the United States for a regional planning
wow,
commission.
Wow.
And the more important part for the citizens who participated, those 57 jurisdictions did actually about 3 months ago sign into law going forward the utilization of the plan. So it's really been an amazing experience.
I imagine this must be really catching on. I mean, from these successes, you must be getting more requests, and as well, are there other organizations that are doing this type of thing?
You know, I actually believe, Sean, that there's quite a nascent movement among people themselves to say, we have to be back more in the process. If you
mm-hmm.
think the core of Jeffersonian democracy is of the people, by the people, and for the people. And I think more and more Americans are recognizing that they've become too distant from the decision-making process about policies that really impact their lives profoundly. So there are lots of things burgeoning up.
Mm-hmm.
There recently, public television did a big project called By the People, and folks could look at their website and see the outcomes. On January 24th in 10 cities around the country, they actually went in with a set of discussion questions and asked the question, what should America's role in the world be today, post 9/11? Post-aftermath of the Iraqi war? Are we really playing the kind of role that we want our nation to play in terms relative to the UN, relative to other nations? There's an example of a project called Deliberative Polling, run out of Stanford University by a professor named Jim Fishkin. He works in large forums where they use randomly selected participants, so you have to be invited to that particular
mm-hmm.
style. But they've looked at public utilities policy questions in Texas. They've looked at what Americans believe should be the critical issues in presidential campaigns. There's an organization called the Study Circles Resource Center, located in Connecticut, that has helped build up an infrastructure all over the country for citizens to participate in small study circles in their communities. This actually grew up in Sweden in a project there prior to its being introduced to the United States. There's something called the National Issues Forum that grew out of work of the Kettering Foundation in Dayton. They pick 2 or 3 policy mm-hmm. issues a year and hold forums all over the country. So there are more and more examples of how citizens can actually participate in this kind of work locally, statewide, and nationally.
So it sounds like this is a real movement to for people to get involved, not just, again, not just casting their votes on a ballot, but really having dialogues and really understanding and sharing ideas. Now, I'm wondering, well, first of all, something that makes your organization rather unique, as I see it, is this really unique use of technology. I mean, you're able to take a room literally with 5,000 people and network them together in such a way that, that allows for a pretty authentic, facilitated dialogue among 5,000 people, and that's just amazing to me. Could you talk more about the technical aspects of how that's done?
I'd be delighted to, Sean. Part of what drove us and motivated us to use these technologies that are out there is an understanding that for an elected official to agree to act on a group of citizens' information, it has to be large enough and representative enough that he or she can hold confidence that this is actually reflecting their whole community, or in some cases, the whole nation. So it is a very wonderful integration of the intimacy of face-to-face dialogue in small tables, then supported by this technology that allows you to aggregate the data, synthesize the data, and summarize the data, and then show those summaries right back to the people real time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the technology's capacity to take a mass of data, summarize it, give it back in meaningful form to the very same people who generated it. So this is not going away to some other group to analyze
right.
it, to some other team to put their view on it. It's the very same people who produced it. And to do all of that in a very timely way, so that most of our forums run from 9 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. And conventional wisdom in this country says people can't give up a day. They're too busy. They don't have enough time. Our experience is exactly the opposite. If you show people that this is really a creative, safe public space, they are going to be respected, they are going to be listened to, and what they say at the end of the day is going to have an impact on decision makers, they will come out in very large numbers.
I'm wondering, what do you think the limit would be? I mean, 5,000 in New York, is this something you could push to 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, a million? I mean, where would you draw the line, number one, with technology? I imagine there's no reason why you couldn't network, a few thousand computers. But what is the kind of critical mass or threshold that you would ultimately like to achieve in a city like New York?
That's a great question. I think we believe that in terms of at the same moment in time, in the same place, there's probably not a reason to want to go larger than, say, 10,000. Because by that point, you're really replicating kind of time and time again the general view held by different subgroups of the population. But let's take on an issue like healthcare reform in the United States, which we know is an increasingly painful reality, not just for very poor people, but for middle-class people.
Mm-hmm.
Because as corporations again are going through a cycle of pushing more costs onto their employees, there are a lot of families under serious stress as to whether or not they can care for their families with really an insurance program that works for them. We've been working with Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah and Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, who passed a bill last year called the Healthcare for All Americans Act. And they want to sincerely engage the public in a nationwide discussion on healthcare reform. And their feeling is this has to get to hundreds of thousands of people, if not a million people.
And not just voting, but interacting. Right?
Actually interacting. Mm-hmm. So America Speaks has coordinated and convened about 17 organizations,
really?
All the ones I named before, plus a lot of organizations that have online capacity, to say, let's take this seriously. Let's say that in the year 2005, we want to hold a national dialogue in the United States in which a million people don't just do a quick off-the-cuff response to a poll, but spend 4 or 5 or 6 hours dialoguing on the nexus of issues around the cost, the quality, and the access to health care services and insurance in this country. Is that possible to do? And I'm delighted to say to you and your listeners that we now understand a way that would engage, it would take about a year, and there'd be many different forms. Some of them would be our 21st century town meetings. Some of them would be rotary clubs and churches and small organizations in communities taking those same questions, the same discussion guides, and doing it on their own, and then aggregating that through an organization like the League of Women Voters or 4-H, and bringing all that together so that you could actually take to the United States Congress the outcomes of a discussion of potentially a million people.
Wow, that will be absolutely amazing to see, and I certainly look forward to hearing more about it. What's the timeline for that?
I believe that this will probably not be able to be implemented until after the next presidential election. Presidential elections really take all the energy and, frankly, all the media focus. So I presume that there will be a real dialogue from an issues point of view between the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate for the presidency. So some of the groundwork on the content of the discussion will undoubtedly be laid in the year 2004. But to really begin this broad sweep of the general public into a meaningful dialogue, I think you can look for it to start in early February of 2005.
Very exciting. Now, I want to get back to trying to analyze this idea of numbers a little more. As you mentioned, you get to a certain critical mass of opinions and viewpoints, and it's fair to say that you can have a pretty good idea of where the population stands on any particular issue. But you start to extend that beyond that number, and there's an added value, is there not, in the actual individual participatory effect, and the idea that my voice matters. If I'm one of 10 or if I'm one of 10,000, when I see that my exact concern flashes up on the screen, that, again, it makes me feel as though I'm connected to the democracy more.
And, in fact, you are connected to it more. One of the things that we don't yet have a systematic enough way to do is collect all the stories we hear back from people of how participating in this kind of process impacted their lives after they were at Listening to City or after they were at Community Compass, which is the program that I mentioned in Ohio, or after the Citizen Summit in D.C. But let me give you a couple of examples. I heard recently from a woman who participated in Listening to the City who said that she was delighted to say that almost a full 2 years later, the spark that had been ignited in her around a knowledge that a single voice can make a difference was still happening for her in her local community. She happens to live in Massachusetts in an area that's very proud of its school system and that has been on a track of continuing to build additional physical buildings for schools. And yet, over time, a lot of citizens in the community began to feel like the amount of taxes they were paying to build schools, I'm literally talking here about the buildings, there was a question of, do we really have to go that far on the physical plant? Are we potentially on a track here of too much money being spent on the physical plant, and we ought to be paying attention more to the quality of teaching in the classroom, et cetera, et cetera. And again, particularly in a D.C. context, I want to be sure to elucidate that this is a community which already had very viable buildings, beautifully appointed physical, unlike D.C., where we should be embarrassed by the physical buildings that many of, shamed by the physical buildings that many of our students spend their days in. But in this case, there'd just be kind of a norm that the community was responsible for always passing a bond issue for additional buildings. And this woman felt strong enough to stand up in a community meeting and speak her voice saying, I believe we've paid too much attention to actually the beauty of the buildings, the winning of architectural awards, and we need to refocus our dollars and our resources on expanded programs and not so much into physical plant. Well, it turned out that actually many people in the community were feeling that, but no one had been brave enough in a public meeting to be the person who stood up and spoke against the next physical building bond issue. So it was quite an extraordinary experience for her to understand that it's highly likely, if I'm thinking this and feeling this, many other people in my community may be thinking and feeling exactly the same thing. Someone has to have the courage to speak out first.
Mm-hmm. You know what that makes me think of is in this election year, the notion of voting, the concept of voting is something that I think a lot of people often reflect upon. And the old kind of cliche, my vote doesn't matter, I think has a lot of truth to it. I mean, in the sheer numbers, one vote really doesn't make a difference. But the reason a vote could be cast can depend on a lot of different things. And what you were just talking about suggests that if I have a confidence, or if I have an understanding with other people around me that they also feel a certain way, that actually gives my vote more strength because I feel a connection as opposed to me just casting a lone vote. So I'm thinking of this difference between my vote matters versus my voice matters. And when you have gatherings such as the 21st Century Town Meeting, it's not that one person's vote matters so much as their influence on the group that they interact with in both ways, that they may help someone else see an issue differently and vice versa. And so it seems to me that truly is an experience where they matter and they know they matter. Am I kind of filtering this reasonably?
Well, you know, Sean, what stimulated for me when what you've just said, voting has become very much too much an alone process in this country.
Right, right.
People do not feel connected to other people in the voting process. And that's part of what leaves them feeling like my vote doesn't make mm-hmm. a difference. And I think I probably come out a little bit different than where you ended, is I think both their voice and their vote matters.
Sure.
And if you can connect both of those to a collective community process mm-hmm. where people can visibly see how their voice impacts an outcome, then how their vote is part of the whole group that votes on that outcome, in the end, they simultaneously have the experience that my voice mattered, I influenced the content that we came to, I influenced the priorities in the mayor's budget, I helped develop the group's priorities, and then in the end, I also individually voted on them.
Mm-hmm.
So it did come out that education was higher in the ranking than something else. So I think I really have learned very much just by listening to people's pain in this country about how distraught and disgusted they are with the electoral political process. And it has led literally hundreds of thousands of people to feel like their vote doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you look at how narrow the balance is of the number of votes that decide a direction...
Just look at 2000.
Exactly. One of the things that I believe we have to do to help people reattach to an understanding of the power of voting is to, in fact, bring processes back into the community that lead up to the vote in a way that I understand my vote is linked to the voices of other people that care about the same issues that I care about. It's a kind of rebuilding of community. It's a kind of, you know, people often talk about the Iowa caucuses as such mm-hmm. an esoteric process.
Mm-hmm.
But if you saw some of those on C-SPAN this year, they're absolutely compelling discussions of people's deep beliefs about why my vote for Gephardt or why my vote for Kerry or why my vote for Kucinich or whichever person. This is what's linked in my values and my beliefs about why this particular person will carry that forward. And you could sit and watch on television how people's minds changed by people's ability to articulate what they believe these men would do if they were elected.
Right. I just look at the polls going into that, and then afterwards, one has to realize that the human dialogue interaction is what really shifted that. You know, this begs the question, does the 21st century town meeting format lend to an electoral process, or is this something that really should be used for the policy making issues? I mean, I can imagine, I mean, using the caucuses almost as a model of some sort. Could you imagine a nationwide, perhaps computer mediated caucus of some sort?
That's quite an image, Sean. Our team has talked quite a bit about the issue of would the 21st century town meeting be appropriate to be used in an electoral contest. And at first blush, there's a quick reason to say no. And that reason is because it's very critical that this method stay totally nonpartisan, mm-hmm. totally bipartisan, that it get at the issue of people's values and their beliefs about policy, that it not be taken over by partisan politics. But setting that aside, which would mean it would be tragic if it got used by the Republicans, but not the Democrats or something like that. We've actually had some interesting discussions, for example, with the League of Women Voters.
Mm-hmm.
Would there be a way to have this dialogue be part of a very reinvented presidential debate, where, in fact, the candidates were looking in-depth at some issues, not trying to score points against each other.
Right, with sound bites and, yeah.
Exactly. But where there actually was a citizen dialogue that was pretty deep on a couple of issues, and that the citizens were then able to put forward the challenges they wanted for the candidates
mm-hmm.
or the outcomes they wanted the candidates to then explain how their policy position would actually produce this in healthcare or would actually produce this in education. And, you know, we're a long way from, I think, being in a position to test that, but it's a pretty intriguing image if you think about really deepening the dialogue with these candidates rather than trying to score points.
Really? Boy, that sure would be exciting to see something like that. And I have no doubt that I'm sure we will, given the momentum of America Speaks and others and this whole new movement towards a real deliberative democracy process that brings people into more than just making their check on a ballot and dropping in the ballot box and really coming together and spending a day talking with fellow citizens. We're just about out of time here, but I had a couple of really quick questions I wanted to ask. First of all, who funds these huge events? I imagine it must be an incredible undertaking financially to make something like Listening to the City go off.
You know, in most of the big issues facing our society, most citizens have recognized that the funding has to come from the public sector, the private sector, and foundations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very pleased to say that in every single project we've done in this country, the sources of funding have been some government funds, some private foundation funds, and some private business funds.
Fantastic. And I should point out that the majority of the facilitators that actually work at these events are volunteering. Is that correct?
That is such a wonderful statement of who we are as a nation. For example, at Listening to the City, literally there were professional people who make their living facilitating mm-hmm. came from all 50 states in the country volunteering their services to be the person at a table to ensure that the discussion at each table is democratic. Because you know that some of us are more extroverted, some of us are more introverted, so you have to have someone at the table that really keeps it a level playing mm-hmm. field, allows every perspective to be spoken. And across the country in all of our events, that role is played by professional people who make their living facilitating, but they choose to give back to the community in this way as a public service.
Well, if that is not a testament to the amazing potential of the American people and others to come together in times like this, I don't know what is. And it's certainly very encouraging to hear about all the work that you and your organization is doing. Again, America Speaks right here in Washington, D.C., facilitating mass-scale dialogues and bringing people together to make important decisions about public policy issues facing our nation. And as you were mentioning that, actually in New York, there were actually facilitators from outside of the country, were there not?
There actually were. There were some people from, I guess it was 7 different nations that actually saw this on the website and volunteered to come. And we thought that was quite a statement, and we're delighted to have them.
These are people that sometimes make, $1,000, $1,500 a day, and they come and volunteer their time doing that. That's fantastic. Well, do you have any final comments you'd like to make? We're just about out of time.
Sean, I'm just delighted to have been invited here to have a chance to talk with you and your audience. I would like to give our website for
Absolutely.
People who might be interested in getting involved in a project. It's www.americaspeaks.org.
And there's a link to America Speaks on conflictradio.org, where you can listen to this show and other prior shows on conflict right here on WGMU. That's it for today. Again, I want to extend a very warm thank you to Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, founder and president of America Speaks. And until next week, I'm your host, Sean Dunning. Thanks for listening.